Welcome to today's program titled, Washington's Paid Family and Medical Leave Law. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, I would now like to introduce our host for today's call, Jillian Murphy. You may now begin.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about this new and exciting and somewhat mysterious law, paid family medical leave. Joining me today are my colleagues who have been, we've all been following this, Kate, Angela, and Nas. I think we've been doing what you guys have been doing, sort of trying to devour anything that comes from the Employment Security Department, waiting on pins and needles for the rules to be released, the remaining rules, going to some of the presentations, and then even communicating directly with folks from the ESD. And I think from all those activities, we've got a fairly good idea of what's going to happen, but there's still some things that we don't know, but we'll do our best to let you know what we do know and kind of give you some best guesses on some of the rules that might be coming out a little bit later. So I looked at the RSVP list, and I saw a lot of friendly names on the list, clients that we've worked with in the past. I do want to take an opportunity to make sure that our chat feature is working. So perhaps maybe I'll throw it out to the group. Has anybody considered doing a voluntary plan? If anybody's either submitted one or thinking about doing that, perhaps you could let us know by letting me see on the chat feature. And nothing's coming through, which very well may mean that no one's doing a voluntary plan, and I don't blame you. How about somebody say hello? Let me just make sure it's working. Can somebody type in hello on the chat feature? Let's see. Well, we'll keep moving on that. Okay, so today we're going to go over a couple of things, and I'm going to advance the slide here. Oh, there, Kelsey is telling me hello. Thank you, Kelsey. I appreciate that. Feel free to shout out questions as we go. We'll certainly try to answer them if we can, and we'll see what we can do to get your questions answered. And I guarantee there's going to be some questions we don't know the answer to, but we'll do our best. So for today, we really want to give a high-level overview of what this program is. And I know some of you joining us, this may be something that kind of came onto your radar a little bit late, and that's okay. We still have time to get into compliance. We want to talk about voluntary plans, this sort of this idea that you can generously fund this plan internally. I think the last count was there was about maybe 50 employers in the whole entire state that have even submitted their plans to be approved. You have to submit your voluntary plan and have it approved by the Employment Security Department, which is the agency that is overseeing this program. So not a lot of folks are taking that option for pretty good reasons, but we do have a couple of clients who it made sense for them to do that. So we'll talk about, is it too late to apply? Do you want to do it next year? What are some of the kind of rules around that? And then most importantly, since here we are on December 18th, what do we need to do to prepare for January 1st? And we've got some tips on that. So moving right along. Okay. So very sort of basic, this is a statewide insurance plan. So it feels different than, you know, we're thinking of this as like a paid sick leave plan or some sort of new rule that requires you to provide leave. It's not that. What it is, though, is a statewide insurance plan, not unlike an unemployment insurance plan. And in fact, it's run by the same folks who run unemployment. And it's going to require employers to do a couple of things. First of all employers of all size are going to be required to send in quarterly reports to the unemployment agency folks, the ESD, through a portal that I don't think is yet to, I still think we're waiting on it being created, but you'll be required to report hours worked and additional information about your workforce, similar to what you do for unemployment, every quarter. The program is going to be funded by premiums paid by both the employer and employee, although that's only for employers that are over 50 employees in Washington State. So if you're an employer that is over 50 employees in Washington State, you, employer, are going to be paying into this program, and then your employees are going to be paying into this program. If you're a smaller employer, your employees are going to be paying into this program. It's not optional. It's not, you can't opt out of this program. Employees don't have a right to say, you know, I'd rather just take my chances and not participate in this. They are required to provide some funds to this program, and as such, you, employer, are required to make those deductions and send that money in to the ESD every quarter. That's what's going to be happening all through next year. And then it's not until January 1st, 2020, where employees will actually have the right to start getting these benefits. And so what it'll be, and you'll see in this last sentence here, employees who are eligible, meaning they've got they need to be absent from work for a certain purpose, and it really mirrors the FMLA in most ways and then doesn't in some key ways that we'll talk about. But employees, if they're absent from work for one of those reasons, they can let the state know. The state will ask them a bunch of questions. And if the state agrees that they fit the eligibility requirements, the state will start sending them a check for getting some of their wages replaced during that 12-week period primarily. It also can go up to 16 weeks or 18 weeks depending on the purpose that you're absent. And we'll talk about kind of what those purposes are here in a minute. But that's the general concept. It's an insurance program. For folks who might have employees in California, it's somewhat similar to the state disability leave there, but it's certainly new here in Washington. And you may have remembered this. This was something that was kind of, it was on, it's been sort of coming down the pike for years now, and it was just, the issue was they couldn't quite figure out how to fund it. So they finally sort of pulled the trigger on it. But I think there's still some concerns about how this program is really going to be able to sustain itself. So it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. So who must comply? Pretty much everybody. I'm assuming everybody on the phone must comply. It's employers of all sizes. Again, even if you're a very small employer, you still have some things you're going to have to be doing here. You may not have to contribute the dollars, but you're going to have to be doing some things, and this is going to affect you. So basically, all employers that have employees in Washington must participate. Even if you're an employer that is headquartered outside of Washington, if you've got employees working in Washington, kind of similar to how we would think about paid sick leave, you're gonna be on the hook to comply with this. We'll talk about this a little bit later here, but you may be wondering, well, what if I have employees who work part-time in Washington and part-time in Idaho, or part-time in Washington, part-time in Oregon? You'll need to kind of go through an analysis to determine whether, A, you're an eligible employer, and B, whether these are the types of employees that you need to be gathering those premiums from. And the rules are a little more confusing than you might hope or expect. This does include businesses of all sizes and nonprofits, charities, and religious organizations. I do think there's been some misinformation out there that certain employers don't have to comply. So really, the only exceptions here are the federally recognized tribes, who have an option to opt in, federal employees. Even self-employed individuals have an option to opt in. And then some employees subject to collective bargaining agreements, but we will talk about that a little later. And then, so that's that last slide was who are the employers that are going to have to deal with this. This slide is about whether an employee is eligible. So employees are going to be eligible for this leave, eligible for these benefits, and that's a big distinction. We'll talk about the difference between a right to be absent versus a right to get these benefits from the state. But employees who have worked at least 820 hours in Washington during the qualifying period, which is defined as the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters, are eligible for these benefits. So that might sound familiar. That's real similar to unemployment benefits. If you worked in Washington for the first four of the last five quarters, you get these benefits. You're eligible. So this doesn't have to do with how long you've been working for a certain employer. You don't have to work for a certain employer for a certain amount of time to be eligible. And in fact, employees can meet this 820 hours by working for more than one employer, perhaps part-time for two employers at the same time. So 820 hours, that's not much. So basically, starting in 2020, most employees working in Washington are going to be eligible for these benefits. I'm going to turn it over to, I believe, Naz to talk about unions. Naz, are you on the line?
Hi, everyone. Yes, I am. So I am excited to talk about unions. So this is an area that's been giving a lot of employers a lot of stress, and rightfully so. This is an area that was addressed early on by the state in terms of how it's going to affect unionized employees. However, it probably has the least amount of information publicly available on it. So what about unions? They are covered too on the next contract. Now, the language put out in the rule is very ambiguous because it essentially says that whenever a collective bargaining agreement, or let me take a step back. So employees that are subject to collective bargaining agreements that were in effect before October 19th, 2017 are not required to comply until the collective bargaining agreement expires, is reopened, or is renegotiated. Now, the terms expire, reopened, and renegotiated are slightly ambiguous. So whatever agreement you had in effect October 19th, 2017, whenever that contract was set to expire, that's the trigger point. So for example, if you have a collective bargaining agreement that was in effect October 18th, 2017, that was set to expire December 31st, 2019, and you extended it, the December 31st, 2018 initial expiration date is the trigger for paid family medical leave. So what is the state talking about here? Well, if you have a collective bargaining agreement and you it doesn't expire until 2020, but you want to do a reopening of that current exempt agreement where you actually renegotiate all aspects of it, you can do that, and it will trigger PFML responsibilities under the new law. However, otherwise, it's specifically limited to the new contract after the previous contract expires. So employers with a unionized workforce, at that point, once the contract expires, the next day they are expected to contact the ESD, provide them with information that the previous contract has expired, and at that point, the companies are expected to record certain information that we'll discuss later on in the presentation, as well as begin remitting premiums from employees if they so choose to do so. So, and this is just an area that's causing a lot of frustration because, as we all are familiar with, collective bargaining is not necessarily the fastest process, and there's a lot of different terms to consider, and so anybody that has a contract that's expiring, they want to be able to have some time to negotiate with these different deductions as to whether or not the employer is going to take on the full deduction or whether or not they're going to accept deductions from the union employee. So that's something that's looming in the background. And in full disclosure, I expect a lot of questions on the union, so feel free, send the questions my way, and I will review and answer as they come up. Okay, so how does it, in practicality, affect unions? So it's the same process, for the most part, as how it impacts other employees that are non-union. So to be eligible for benefits, an employee covered under a collective bargaining agreement must have worked at least 820 hours during the qualifying period. Now, what's interesting about this is if you are in a exempt contract that was in effect October 19th, 2017, and your contract expires, let's say, December 31st, 2019, come January 1, 2020, even though there's been no payment made into this fund. Union employees, if they have worked the 820 qualifying hours, they will be eligible to take this leave despite not having contributed to the fund. So in that situation, if you have an employee that in 2020 becomes eligible because the previous contract expired, and they start the process with ESD to take this leave, the state's going to reach out to the employer and say, I need information about how many hours they've worked and the wages that they've earned. And the employer is required to provide that data within 10 calendar days back to the state so that they can make an assessment. So that is pretty much the bulk of the information that we have on unions at the moment. ESC is still in the process of figuring quite a bit of the information out. However, with unions, with every agreement, it's so different. So happy to answer any specific questions you may have as well. I'm going to hand it over to Angela to continue on with the requirements under PFML.
Thanks, Naz. So we've talked a little bit about what employers are covered and when employees become eligible for these benefits. And so let's talk a little bit about what are qualifying events. The first one is an employee's own serious health condition. So that is covered by this new law. There's also family leave events that are covered. That includes caring for a family member with a serious health condition or bonding after the adoption, birth, or placement of a foster child who's under 18 years old. And then like the FMLA and the existing state law equivalent, certain military-connected events are also covered by this new law. Now, one important thing to note here is that the definition of family member has expanded and changed. So not only does it include children, parents, spouses, siblings, grandparents, and grandchildren, the definition is now broad enough to include parents-in-law, grandparents-in-law, and then grandparents and grandchildren that were not covered by the previous, by the FMLA and the state law equivalent. So there's going to be some additional uses for employees to take this leave. And you should also note as well that you know, taking leave, taking these benefits for, you know, grandparents or grandparents-in-law, that would be a use outside of the FMLA. So it's an additional use with this new law. So how is this leave actually going to work? So for all leaves except for the birth or placement of a child, there's going to be a 7-day waiting period for these benefits. And, you know, to receive these benefits, employees are actually going to have to make a request, file a claim with the ESD. So they file a claim with the ESD. They have an obligation to notify their employer as well that they're requesting these benefits. And then if they meet the eligibility requirements, so they've worked 820 hours in the last four of the last five calendar period, and they've also they have a qualifying event, then they will be qualified or eligible for these benefits. And once the ESD approves the application and the employee's on the state plan, the ESD will pay the benefits directly to the employee. An additional thing to note here is that the minimum claim duration is 8 hours. So 8 hours is the minimum amount of leave that an employee can take under this new plan. So let's talk a little bit about the current law and what benefits exist, and then what's going to change in 2020. So currently, employees can take 12 weeks of leave in a 12-month time period. That leave is unpaid. Some employers may have paid leave policies or short-term disability policies that may cover that leave, but generally speaking, that leave is unpaid. Starting in 2020, under the new law, employees can take 12 weeks or more of leave, and that includes up to 16 weeks of leave if there's both a family and a medical event, and then up to 18 weeks of leave if the employee has a pregnancy-related health condition. Now, a huge change is that the leave is going to be paid. It's funded through premiums by both the employer and the employee, and the benefit amount itself is going to depend on the employee's actual wages, and it's going to be capped at $1,000 per week maximum. And then with regards to employee eligibility, we also have a change in scope here as well, and there's going to be more employees who are going to be eligible for this leave. So currently under the FMLA and the state law equivalent, only workers who worked 1,250 hours in the last 12 months for their current employee who has 50 or more employees are going to be eligible for leave. So basically, you have to work for your employer for 12 months, it has to be a large employer, and you have to have worked 1,250 hours to be eligible for leave. Under the new law, starting in 2020, all workers who've worked 820 hours for any employer in Washington are going to be eligible for this leave. It's a portable benefit between employer to employer. So employees don't have to have been with the same employer for 12 months or more, and it doesn't have to be a large employer for the employee to be eligible. So there's going to be a lot more employees who are going to be eligible for these benefits. One thing to note here as well is while, you know, the FMLA is a federal law, the state law equivalent, the Washington Family Leave Act, is going to sunset once this new law comes into effect. So, and we will have the Paid Family Medical Leave Act is going to replace the current law. And then how is this program going to be funded? So the employees are going to have all these opportunities to take leave for their own medical issue, for family medical issues, for more family members than are currently eligible. So it's going to be a state insurance program. It's funded through a shared premium of 0.4% of the employee's total wages. The premium has to be collected and remitted on a quarterly basis by employers to the state. And then employees can apply for benefits starting in January 2020. So how are these premiums going to work? Essentially, that 0.4% of the employee's gross pay, so that doesn't include tips, it's gross pay, a third of that total premium is allocated towards family leave, and the employee is responsible for all of that that third of the portion for family leave. And then two-thirds of the premium is allocated for medical leave. And then for large employers in Washington State, as Jillian mentioned, those large employers who have 50 or more employees, they are responsible for paying the employer portion of the premium, as well as collecting and remitting the employee portion. Now, for small employers who have less than 50 employees, they are not required to pay the employer portion, but they still have to collect and remit the employee portion. And under these new rules as well, employers can be more generous than what's required by law. So a large employer could choose to pay both the employee and the employer portion, and likewise a small employer could choose to pay the employee portion of the premium. So just something to think about as you're planning for the next year. And here's just an example of how the premium actually is going to break down. So assume that an employee earns $2,500 per paycheck. The first step here would be to calculate the employee premium. So that's the 0.4%, that's $10 total is going to be the premium. And then the second step would be to calculate which is the employer portion and which is the employee portion. So the employee pays all of the family leave portion of the premium, so that's $3.33, and then the employer and the employee split the medical leave portion. So the employee pays $3 out of that, and then the employer pays $3.67. So the total breakdown, the total employee contribution of that $10 premium for a large employer is the employee's paying $6.33, and the employer is paying $3.67 of that premium. So how are these premiums going to be paid? So beginning January 1, 2019, employers are required to start collecting these premiums from employee paychecks. And we're going to talk a little bit more about how to notify employees about this and what sort of reporting requirements come along with this a little bit later in the presentation. Again, employers who are large, who have 50 or more employees based in Washington, must pay towards the medical leave premium, but small businesses with 50 or less employees are not required to pay towards that premium but can opt in. The premiums are going to be submitted on a quarterly basis to the state through this portal that the state is still working to develop. And the only employers who can opt out of this is if they have an approved voluntary plan from the state. And Kate's going to be talking a little bit more about the voluntary plan issues and key considerations that employers have in determining whether or not a voluntary plan is appropriate for them. So I'm going to hand it over to Kate.
Thanks, Angela. And before we transition to talking about voluntary plans, we have received a few questions, and I will address those now. The first, does the definition of family member include domestic partners and children of domestic partners? And what the definitions tell us under the law is that, yes, a state-registered domestic partner qualifies as a spouse, and so that would be a covered employee. And given that a registered domestic partner is considered a spouse, the children of the domestic partners would also be covered under the paid family medical leave program. An additional question, and I'll touch on some of these. A couple more came in just now, but I'll touch on some, and then we can follow up at the end. There is a question on if the Family Leave Act sunsets, what will that reduce the additional bonding leave currently in place for birth mothers? And what we have now under the state law is that if there's a period of disability associated with pregnancy, a woman would be entitled to that under our state law equivalent of the FMLA, and then it would have the FMLA run after that period of disability. And what the program has done to address that, what the new program has done, is say that there's an extension of the leave to up to 18 weeks if there's pregnancy-related complications. And so it doesn't mirror the state law in that it would cover potentially the whole period of disability, but it will extend to up to 18 weeks to address that issue. And then as far as, I'll take one more question and then we can follow up on the end on some additional ones. There were a couple questions about small business size. What do you do if a small business reaches 50 employees in June or July of 2018? And then there was a similar follow-up on that. What they do, they'll look at the size of the company on a quarterly basis and then make a determination of that employer size. So say for the first quarter, you're under 50 employees, you would not do the employer deduction. Once you get to 50 employees, then the employer deduction would start. And so for those employers who are maybe right on the edge of that 50, my advice would be to reach out to ESD and get clarification from them. Let them know when you hit 50 employees so that they can help you navigate when you need to start taking that employer contribution. And then I'll move to voluntary plans, and then we can circle back to questions at the end. Voluntary plans. So I saw at the very beginning when Jillian was starting off, that it looks like from the feedback that we were getting in is that most people are saying no, not to a voluntary plan, at least not right now. And that would probably be the right answer given that it's December 18th. So if you do not have an application pending at this time or if you do not already have an approved voluntary plan, my advice is to sit tight and wait for some more rulemaking in 2019. What a voluntary plan is it's an employer-operated paid family medical leave program. An employer has the option to say, hey, state, thanks for setting this up, but we would rather administer this ourselves. And you can do that for both the family leave portion and the medical leave portion, or you can opt to cover one. For example, a lot of employers are looking at it and saying, we have generous benefits under short-term disability, generous leave policies for medical issues related to the employee. So we want to do a voluntary plan for the medical leave portion. We are already providing equivalent benefits, and then we'll opt to the state on the family leave portion, which, as Angela covered, is 100% an employee contribution. And so I would say about half the clients that I've worked with looking at voluntary plans have opted for medical only. The other half have just opted for both wanting to just administer it themselves and not go through the state. What must you have in order to qualify for a voluntary plan? So first, it must meet or exceed the state requirements. And so that would be the amount of leave, the available usage, family member, similar definition, or you can always be more generous. It must be available to all current and future employees. And so one difficulty that has come up with some companies is your short-term disability may have limitations on who can access that benefit. And the state is telling us you need to make this available to everyone if you do a voluntary plan. You cannot exclude part-time employees or temporary employees or people with pre-existing conditions, for example. The voluntary plan must be approved by ESD before it's offered to employees. And a question we get quite frequently is, okay, if we don't have our voluntary plan approved by December 31st, what does that mean for the future? And what ESD has shared and what we know is that you can apply for a voluntary plan at any point in time. And our advice has pretty consistently been, wait for 2019 to see what happens in the rulemaking process to see if the law is amended so that potentially it may make sense to do a voluntary plan or it may not really make a difference at the end of the day. One issue that has come up now is the ESD is looking to amend the law in that currently there is not an ability for an employer to top off the state benefit with existing leave buckets. The state has, and what I mean by topping off is it's a partial wage reimbursement. So say you have an employee who's receiving the $1,000 weekly wage replacement, but they generally make $2,000. And so you say, well, we have these leave buckets. We'll let you top off so you can get to your full salary replacement. ESD has said no, under the current law, you were prohibited from doing that. And in exploring that with them more, it's an issue with how the law is written, and they are currently working on drafting a bill to address that issue. And so their intent, and we are pushing for an employer who has leave buckets available, can be more generous, can allow that top off so that you're not running into an issue where employees have this long, lengthy paid family medical leave, and then they have your leave bucket still available. Along with voluntary plans, how are they different from the state plans? There are certain eligibility requirements that are different and certain reporting requirements that are different. As far as eligibility, as discussed, an employee who works 820 hours for Washington employers in the last four of the five quarters is eligible under the state program. However, if you opt for a voluntary plan, there's a different eligibility requirement. You must meet the state requirements, and that employee must work for you for 340 hours before you can offer them your voluntary plan. The state, as it sits right now, is telling us, no, you cannot just automatically put people on your voluntary plan when they start with you, unless they're coming from an employer who had a voluntary plan. And this really doesn't make any sense to us. Because honestly, do you think that people that are coming on to work are going to necessarily know whether or not they're coming from an employer that had a voluntary plan? And most clients that we've worked with would rather just put employees directly onto their voluntary plan. So this is another issue that ESD has shared with us, that they're looking at amending the law so that 340 days can be removed so that an employer has the ability to put them straight on a voluntary plan. The premium, so you, if you opt for a voluntary plan, you can still take an employee deduction. It does not mean that you're taking on the full responsibility of the premium deductions. You can, you can opt to cover all of it, or you can do the same amount of that, the percentage of the 0.4% gross, and take that employee deduction, but you would be required to hold that money in trust, and so you can't mingle it up with your own general funds. But the employer is not required to set aside funds to account for the employer portion of it. It's in having a voluntary plan, it's assumed that you're going to have those funds available for use. The premium payments, if you do not have a voluntary plan in place, would start January 1, 2019. There's no requirement to start premium payments if you have a voluntary plan, just that you're going to be providing the benefits to your employees. And then, again, the weekly benefits would be no less than what the state plan requires. Job protection is a little different. So we see under the state plan that job protection mirrors the FMLA. And so an employee must work for you for 12 months and at least 1,250 hours to qualify for job protection. It's a little different for a voluntary plan, and we are not really sure why. But the state tells us if you have a voluntary plan, an employee who works for you for 9 months and 965 hours in the last 12 months will be eligible for job protection. And so recognizing if you have a voluntary plan, the job protection will kick in a little earlier. What are the special eligibility rules? Again, it must cover all current and future employees. For those clients that have applied and received approval for voluntary plans, one sticking point with ESC does seem to be an inclusion of future employees. They want that language in your policy that you submit as part of your application. And then again, we have the eligibility requirements of 820 hours and 340 with you. They would default to the state program if they haven't hit that threshold 340 hours, but would immediately be enrolled on your plan if they came from a voluntary plan. What is the application process? So our understanding is that voluntary plans have not been particularly popular across the state of Washington. Last checked, I think there are under about 75 applications total that have been submitted, and a percentage of those have been accepted. The approval rate is, or the approval process is taking about 14 days to 30 days, and I think that has stayed pretty consistent since the application process went live. It's a pretty straightforward process. My advice if you're looking to apply for a voluntary plan is make sure you have everything ready to go when you log on to do your application. And what I mean by that is there's a series of questions that are available on the application website, and my advice would be just print those out, write your answers out so you have that in front of you, and then you're required to submit a policy as well. What I'm finding is that the simpler the policy, it seems to be the easier to get approved. So making sure you cover all those bases, but not submitting a mix of your short-term disability and your leave policies and letting ESD figure out how they all interact and how you're meeting those requirements, but submitting instead a simple 1 to 2 page summary policy that outlines how the procedure will work. And then turning it back over to Naz to help you prepare for 2019.
Okay, so 2019 is going to be here before we know it, and there are several things that you can do to prepare for the rollout of PFML. So the first thing we recommend is just providing notice to your employees. This is going to be a deduction that will potentially be taken out of their first paycheck in the next year. So it's important, particularly for just helping everyone be on the same page and understanding why is this money coming out of their next paycheck. So one area of confusion is whether or not there's a particular type of notice that you're supposed to provide, and there's not. However, the state has prepared and provided several different resources that are available to employers in order to provide this information to their employees ahead of the January 1 effective date. So we'll discuss a few of those here in a moment. The other major thing that you need to be prepared for is remitting premiums from employees is expected to begin on the very first paycheck in 2019, regardless of when the wages are actually earned. So starting January 1, whatever the first paycheck is, you want to begin making those deductions if you choose to do so. That's also the starting point for when you want to be collecting information regarding employees, their wages, hours worked, and premiums deducted. Now, Kate's going to discuss that in more detail as to the specific information that you're going to provide to the state. However, something to have on your radar as we're entering into 2019. So, moving ahead. So right now, again, we recommend notifying employees. And then beginning January 1, that is when the premium collection begins. April 1st, 2019, that is when employers are expected to provide their first report that includes several different pieces of information. And based on that information, the state will then reevaluate, making sure that the correct premiums are being paid, the employers are collecting the accurate information and reporting all the required information. And then starting January 1, 2020 is when employees are eligible for getting those benefits. So as I previously mentioned, the state has put out some great resources for employers in the employee handbook that is available on the state website and that we could also provide to you. There is a sample email that you can tailor to your own company's culture and needs and send just an email blast to your employees or perhaps put together a blog post that goes through and then just informs employees of the upcoming new law, what that means for them, that there may be premiums being taken out, just giving them some background information so they're not surprised and so that they feel like you're being open with them and communicating. For some of these employees, they've never heard of this law and they would likely appreciate getting some information. The next resource is that the state has provided an employee pay stub insert. Initially, it seemed that the state was going to provide a poster similar to the other employment posters that you have up in your break room or in HR that will be forthcoming. However, funny thing, this morning I checked, instead of having it ready for January 1, 2019, they have now announced that it will be ready before January 1, 2020. So stay tuned for that. But instead of putting up the ESC poster, ESC has suggested that if employees want to post something regarding the upcoming Washington's Paid Family Medical Leave program and what it entails, they recommend actually using this pay stub insert. This was a resource that they initially created that employers could just insert into their previous paycheck stubs. And so employees could slowly learn about the information and the program that way. However, this is now going to be the main poster that we have available to use to share that information with employees for the next year. So, and then the posting requirements, again, so this is shifted down the road. This is going to be required 2020. So employers must post a notice regarding employee rights under the Paid Family Medical Leave in place where notices are regularly posted. The notice must include specific information, particularly if you are choosing to have a voluntary plan in place. The ESC has made it clear that they will audit employers to make sure proper notice is provided, and a failure to post could result in a penalty of $100 per incident. So the next question is, when can employers deduct premiums? And this is a very important topic. So employers who choose to withhold premiums from their employees may withhold up to 63% of the total premium. Premiums must be withheld each paycheck. So it's super important. Make sure your HR and your payroll departments are in communication. Employers who miss remitting the premiums cannot collect them in a later pay period. At that point, the employer has assumed the responsibility. So very important to make sure that you're ready for that first paycheck deduction. So again, if an employer fails to deduct that share of the premium, the employer has elected to pay that portion of the employee share. So it could have significant financial implications if you're not ready to go before that first paycheck. All right, and now handing it over, I believe, is it to, let's see, Kate Tiley Hertz.
Thanks, Naz. One clarification on the small employer question earlier. In having a little break, I got to look it up. And as a small employer, what they will look at is every year they will look at the size on September 30th. And so that will be the determining factor for a small business as far as when the size is determined. The size of an employer will be calculated once a year on September 30th of each year. The department will average the number of employees reported to an employer over the last four completed calendar quarters. And so keep that in mind for those employers who are right around the 50 mark. A few more questions I'll take now, and then we're happy to stay on at the end of the webinar as well and finish answering questions that have come in. Two questions that have come up previously for us. One, are premiums calculated based on wages paid in 2019, regardless of when earned? So for those employers who have a pay period that spans the 2 years, you are required to remit premiums for that entire paycheck. And this is something we went back to ESD on and also ran by one of our benefits attorneys. It would be similar to any other type of deduction. And so it would be the year those wages are paid in. So if you have a paycheck that spans 2018-2019, you should remit on that full paycheck. Another question to clarify on the small employer piece is whether or not a small employer has to calculate out the premiums or if they just deduct the 0.4% from employees. And what you do is you would not take the 0.4% gross from your employees. What you would do is you would calculate out the employee portion, assuming that, you know, the employer, you'd basically just cross out the employer portion and deduct the remaining from employees. It works out to be 0.268% gross. And so you just take out that portion of the employer. It wouldn't be a higher burden on employees for small employers. I'm going to talk briefly about reporting requirements, and then we will move on to wrapping up and answering the rest of those questions that have come in. What are you required to report? And so we know you have quarterly reporting requirements similar to what you have with unemployment. You must report wages and hours worked by all of your Washington employees beginning in 2019. So the first reporting would be due the end of April. You should start tracking the required information on January 1, and then quarterly reporting is necessary because, as we've mentioned, it's portable between jobs, and so you may have an employee that has two part-time jobs for two different companies, and then those hours together are going to need to be reported to the state. What do you report? What do you report for hours worked for different employees? For your hourly employees, you're going to report their actual hours worked. For an exempt employee, a full-time exempt employee, you will report 40 hours per week. My guess is that for a part-time exempt, you would just do, you know, if they're 50%, you would report 20 hours. It's not clear from the rules. The interesting thing that we have learned from ESD, and it's included in the draft rules that have yet to be finalized, but vacation, sick, PTO, or other paid leave counts as hours worked. So if you have employees out on paid leave, you would include that in your reporting as hours worked. For overtime, you're going to record for hours actually worked, not at an increased 1.5, but hours actually worked. Commission piecework would be actual hours worked. If you have a business where you have required practices, rehearsals, you would report on hours that are spent in the actual required practice or rehearsal. For on-call and standby employees, if they receive wages while they are on call, while they are on standby, you are going to report on the actual number of hours worked while receiving wages on call. So there may be situations when you have an employee who's on unrestricted standby. So they're free to do whatever they want and go wherever they want. You would not report that as hours worked, but if you have someone on restricted standby where they need to stay on site or stay within a mile and they can't do anything fun while they're on call, then you would need to report those hours worked. Then additional reporting requirements. What do you report on your employees? You're going to report information about each individual. So full name, social security number. In addition to what's on the slide, you will provide the zip code where they work to verify that they're a Washington employee, job title, their start date with you, and then the wages paid during the last quarter and the total hours worked during the last quarter, along with the total amount of premiums deducted. And so this portal that they are allegedly coming out with, we hope that it comes out by the first quarter, since you need to be reporting as of April. Our understanding is they're trying to make it as user-friendly as possible, that it should be pretty straightforward, and we look forward to eventually seeing that portal. And so turning it back to Jillian to go over takeaways, and then we will all chime in for any additional questions.
Great. All right, here, let me just advance the slide here. So, I mean, I think immediately, obviously, our first order of a business and probably the easiest thing we can do is to provide employees with a notification of the deductions. They're going to start seeing those in January, and it's a good idea to let them know that that's coming. You can certainly use the language that the ESD recommends. You can tailor that to sort of fit your cultural tone. Just make sure if you do use that language that the ESD provided that you read it through, and because it is drafted to apply to large employers. So if you're a small employer, you're going to want to make some revisions there. Certainly determine whether a voluntary plan makes sense if you haven't already. We're happy to help you think that through and certainly happy to help you apply for one if you feel like doing that anytime next year. Be prepared to start deducting those premiums. Talk with your payroll providers. I've had clients who are finding that their payroll companies are finding it more difficult than you'd think. For example, employers where their employees earn tips, make sure your payroll company is making those calculations based on wages, not tips. You'd think they would be able to figure that out, but I've had clients that are struggling with getting their payroll companies to kind of make those calculations appropriately. So don't just take their word for it that they got it covered. Make sure they're doing it right, because you will ultimately be on the hook for that. Be prepared for that quarterly reporting. You know, I think this is really important. Weighing in on those rules that as they are being drafted, pay attention to those comment periods. Attend those meetings when you can. Speak up about things that are confusing, things that you want them to consider. Because one thing I will say is the ESD has been fairly responsive to those types of comments and questions. So the more we all kind of can weigh in on this. And if you ever have a comment or a question that you want us to send along to the ESD that kind of protects your identity there, we're happy to do that. We've got some folks we've been dealing with over there that can give us some good information. Certainly modify your handbooks and policies at some point in 2019. Sort of right away, I would recommend modifying that part that you may have in your handbook that talks about the types of deductions you take from paychecks. It usually lists out Social Security and unemployment. You're going to want to add that this is another deduction that you're going to start taking. And then next year, be thinking about, does the fact that my employees are going to start having access to this benefit change, or should it change, or do we want to change the mix of benefits that we offer? And so, for example, if you have a short-term disability plan, do you want to change your short-term disability plan so that folks can't double dip? Or, do you want to reduce the overall benefits that you now provide given that folks are going to have access to these benefits? These are some things that we need to be thinking about over the course of next year. And then complying with those poster requirements, which sounds like we've got some time on that. So just be thinking this through. You may be asked some questions, obviously, by your employees. I'd say when in doubt, refer them to the ESD website, since, as you know, we've all discovered, we don't have all the answers. So let's not try to sort of direct our employees or answer questions that we don't know the answer to. There is a lot of good information on the ESD's website, so feel free to give that website link to your employees It might be a good idea to put that in the notice itself that you send out to folks. And let's see, I think that is the end. My other co-hosts, are there any other questions that you feel like we should answer here?
This is Kate. I can answer some of the questions we've come up and then can turn it over to Angela, Naz, and Jillian if you want to jump in on some of the Q&As we've received. One clarification on the, yes, the recorded version of this will be available after. That is an easy softball question. Thank you for that. One question that came up as far as recording on whether or not you would record severance hours. If you are paid in lieu of notice, that would count as hours worked. And so I think the severance hours would potentially be a gray area. I would probably err on the side of counting them if you're giving a specific amount of severance amount, or that would be a good thing to run by ESD and say, you know, this employee has been terminated. Do we need to report on those hours? And then there's a question, how will this leave work with intermittent leave? Does the 7-day waiting period apply each time or only need to be satisfied once per condition? And so for the first question, how will it work with intermittent leave? This leave must be taken as it's currently drafted, must be taken in no less than 8-hour increments. And so for your FMLA intermittent leave that's less than 8-hour increments, which could be in 1-hour increments, they will not be able to access this leave. This leave is intended to cover the longer periods of illness or disability, serious health conditions. The 7-day waiting period, somebody else can chime in here, but my understanding is that it would apply for each condition, but not each time you would need the leave. So, again, if you think about it in terms of being out in at least 8-hour increments, I don't think the intent would be that there'd be a 7-day waiting period for each time you needed to take leave for the same health condition, but I welcome my colleagues to chime in if they believe differently.
Well, and this is Jillian. I think that's right, and I think we're still waiting on rules for that, but it kind of highlights one of these issues here where, whether your employee gets access to benefits, to the actual dollars in their pocket, is a different question sometimes than whether you can allow them to be absent from work. So as we had mentioned, that the leave itself is not job protected unless the employee basically meets all those FMLA eligibility requirements, has been there with you for a year, has worked 1,250 hours, those kinds of things. So unless, if it's not job protected, smaller employers out there, if they haven't been with you that long, then you're going to have to determine whether you can allow them to be absent, and we're kind of doing that ADA analysis at that point. But for the most part, for your employees that do qualify for FMLA, because, the conditions that you can take this leave for really mirror those. I mean, there's going to be a couple situations, like how about I can take leave to care for my grandma under the state plan and get benefits, but that is not a covered person that I can typically take FMLA leave for. So that would potentially not be, you're going to have some issues where your FMLA leave is not running concurrently. But so I bring that up to say that for the most part, intermittent leave, you're going to have to allow folks to be absent under the FMLA, but whether they get the paid benefits is kind of a separate analysis. So it just highlights that there's just a lot of stuff about particularly how this leave interacts with the FMLA, how this leave interacts with your PTO benefits and your STD benefits that we just don't have the answers to yet.
Mm-hmm. And I think, going back to an earlier question, there was a question, if an employee transfers into Washington State, they may qualify for FMLA but not Washington paid leave. And I think that goes to Jillian's comment, one, that we don't have all the answers in rulemaking, but two, there are going to be circumstances in which you have employees, regardless of the transfer in or out of state, you will have situations where an employee is going to be eligible for FMLA and not eligible for the paid leave benefit, or the reverse. They may have the 820 hours and be eligible to take the paid leave, but not yet be FMLA qualified. So being mindful of how those interact, and we should receive more information in 2019 from ESD on those.
Exactly. And I would just add that if you are in a situation where this person's been with you a month and you don't have to provide them this leave under the FMLA and you can't really have them be absent and it's an undue hardship, it just very well may be that they go off and get these benefits but they don't have a job to return to. So that's how that would shake out. And I do see one question that's kind of related here is about the STD plan. Somebody out there has an STD plan, a short-term disability plan that provides 100% of coverage up to 6 months. Does the topping off clause preclude employees from receiving this benefit, or do they get our STD plus the state plan? What we do know right now is that STD benefits, for whatever reason, are treated a little differently than PTO benefits. So you can allow, currently, employees to receive both STD benefits and the state leave benefit. In other words, the state is not going to look at an employee who may be receiving STD benefits and say, oh, we need to reduce how much their state benefit is. The state will allow them to take both. Now, whether you want to allow them to take both is up to you. You could have an option. Look, you can either take state benefits or you can take our short-term disability benefits. Or perhaps you would say, we'll let you take short-term disability benefits, but we will reduce those based on what you're getting from the state. That is something that you are likely going to be able to control on your own. And I do have clients who are electing to just keep their STD plan kind of the way it is, keep their generous PTO plans, but still, instead of trying to do a voluntary plan, still doing the state plan. And then employees will essentially have an option, and in some instances it will be more beneficial to them to do one versus the other. But you can continue to maintain that and offer that choice.
And we are happy to stay on and answer all the questions that we have if people are interested to stay on to hear their answers. Another one, is an employee notice still required if you got approved for a voluntary plan? Congratulations on your approval. If so, any specifics required? My advice on that, there's no requirement to provide a notice, but from an employee relations standpoint, it's a great idea to do so, and we can help with modifying the notification from the toolkit to provide that notice. One point that Nas had brought up earlier to me, not to everybody here, but that if you change the deduction, so if you're paying a portion of the employee premium, and then you change your mind and decide you're going to change that amount, change their deduction, you do need to provide them with at least 2 weeks or one pay period's notice that is going to change. So that is a notification requirement in the actual law. But there's no set requirement. It's just generally a good idea to let your employees know that things are changing since people really love a lot of change with their paychecks or benefits related issues. I'll take one more, and then Nas and Angela and Jillian, feel free to weigh in on the other ones. I'll take a softball. Poster required in 2020, but not 2019, correct? Correct. We don't have a poster, so we have nothing to put up. And as Nas mentioned, that has changed. We thought we were getting it by the end of this year, and now they tell us it will come by the end of next year. So you're not required to put anything up until we have something to put up.
And this is Angela. I see a question about eligibility and who's going to determine that. So the state for the state plan is going to determine employee eligibility issues, and that's why employers need to report information to the state and why employees need to apply to the state for these benefits and then notify their employer of their application for benefits. And then I also saw a question about small employers and, whether or not there is a benefit to paying the employer portion of the premium. So for small employers, they only need to collect and remit the employee portion of the benefits. And that small employer could elect to be more generous and say, hey, look, I'm going to pay the employee portion of this benefit, even though, I'm not required to pay anything. So that, I think you would have to keep in mind that the state may be changing that premium amount. So the premium amount may be going up. We will know more later. That's written into the law. So you want to be mindful of that, morale issues, when you're making a decision as to whether or not you want to be more generous and pay both the employee and the employer portion of the benefits. And I don't know if there's any other questions we want to answer, we're able to answer at this time.
I could jump in, Angela, and answer a few of them. So one of the questions I saw is, if the employer fails to withhold and is responsible for the employee share, is that responsibility for the specific pay period or the entire year? And it's just for that pay period. So if you miss a paycheck, you will be forced to pay that portion, but then you can self-correct on the next one. And then, let's see. Looks like we have one about the first payroll deduction. So for the first payroll deduction, if the pay period ends on December 31st, 2018, but the pay is issued on January 5th, should deductions be applied to that 12-16, 12-31-18 pay cycle? The answer is it doesn't matter. It's just on the very first paycheck in 2019. Let's see. Kate, did you have anything to add on that?
I can jump in on that. And so for the deductions, if somebody is receiving pay on January 1 or later, even if it's for hours worked in 2018, that whole paycheck should have the deductions taken from it, is what ESC has told us. Then additionally, to touch on kind of the overlap of year issue, there's a question: does the life event have to occur in 2020 for the employee to qualify for benefits? For example, if an employee has a baby on 12/31, can they apply for benefits starting in January 2020 after the 7-day waiting period, or will they be ineligible? And so for this specific example, there's a couple different things at play here. The benefit is going to cover baby bonding. And so that person, even though the birth was on 12/31, it doesn't really matter because they would have a qualifying event in 2020. They would be able to take the leave. The second piece to note is that there's an exception to the 7-day waiting period for birth of a child. And so in this situation, this person would be eligible as of January 1, 2020, to access the benefit without a waiting period. Even if something happens in 2019, if they have the serious health condition in effect in 2020, my guess is that they will be eligible. Again, I don't think that's particularly clear from the rulemaking as it stands today, but I would, in this particular situation, they would be eligible, particularly for baby bonding. I saw a couple of questions on out-of-state employees and the need to file waivers. And there's not a lot of clarity on this issue as far as the localization rules and when you make a determination of, one, when an employee is a Washington employee, and two, when you need to actually file a waiver. And I know Angela and Nas and Jillian, feel free to chime in as well on this one, since I know it's one we've been spending a lot of time on in our own lives. But in general, if you have an employee who's coming in and out of Washington a lot, if they look like they may be getting close to the 820 hours, that may be when you need to file a waiver so that they're not covered under the program. If you have an employee who only works in a different state and comes over for a couple of meetings a year, we don't see that there's a need to apply for a waiver for all of your out-of-state employees. That would just be really burdensome for everybody. But in a situation where the employee's regularly in Washington, you can apply for a waiver. So the example they give is somebody who works in Oregon and comes and assists when there's some storm in Washington and works for a period of time. That may be a situation where you'd apply for a waiver. However, if an employee works 820 hours in Washington, your waiver would not remain in place. They would be covered. And I don't know if anybody wants to chime in on that one.
I don't want to chime in on that one. But I do think we have to wrap up here, because I think our time will end here. But I did we get the questions? There's a couple questions about bonuses and commissions and whether those – here we go. I think, yeah, there's a couple questions on that. So no, So folks are asking, no deduction should be taken for bonuses, et cetera. So my understanding is that bonuses may be subject to deductions, as might commissions, but not what we know for sure are not tips. So it's really going to be, you're really going to have to include and fold those bonuses and commissions in. And if you have there's bonuses kind of come in all shapes and sizes. So if you have a specific question about a particular compensation program, we would be happy to discuss that more directly. I think there was one other question that I saw, that whether you can require the use of vacation or PTO time that you might provide folks during that 7-day waiting period. Since there's no requirement around, employers have the right to provide vacation or PTO, and they also don't have to unless it's sick leave, you certainly can require employees to use it during certain periods of time. I would just be careful that, you still, the Washington paid sick leave rules are still in effect, and you can't require folks to use that for issues that are not covered by that, but you can still require folks to use their vacation time or PTO during the waiting period. I haven't seen anything that suggests that you can't. Anything else before we, hosts, did you see any others that you want to answer real quickly before we, and there's lots and lots of questions, so if you guys want to reach out directly, we're happy to do that, but anything else for the good of the order? All right. Well, I think with that, we really appreciate you guys joining us this morning to talk about this. We really are continuing to track this, and as things sort of evolve and we learn more information, we'll look for advisories from us. If you're not on our list of receiving advisories, please reach out and let us know. All of our email addresses are there. We're happy to kind of continue this discussion. And we look forward to working with you in the future. And we'll sign off. Thanks a bunch, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.